All right, please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It's Chelsea from the GEM Group in Harvey's Lake.
Thank you. I'm Chelsea. I'm an alcoholic. Everyone hear me okay? Good volume? Okay. I have a home group. It's the GEM Group in Harvey's Lake, PA. It's about an hour from here. It was not always my home group, but it's probably the best one I've had yet. So let's see where it started. I come from a long line of alcoholics. Luckily, they were all in recovery before I was even born. So my father and both his siblings were in the program by the time I came around. My mother was a drug and alcohol counselor at a rehab. So I grew up in these rooms. I knew the program, I knew the disease of alcoholism, and I spent about 20 years trying to prove that I didn't belong here, and unsuccessfully, obviously. So here I am. I have a sobriety date. It was November 3rd. I had 5 years. I do have a sponsor that I don't use enough. But I have an incredible support group at this point that I do talk to on a daily basis. So my upbringing was pretty normal because my family had gotten sober before I came around. There wasn't a whole lot of chaos. They worked programs. They had the steps in their lives. So all those behaviors that had been there before had pretty much ceased to exist by the time I was there. My family... I have one brother, an older brother, 5 years older than me. He is not one of us. I don't know how that happens. In my case, it was absolutely genetic, but he somehow missed it. So my parents separated when I was like 5, so I don't have many memories of them being together. But my dad, although sober, was a workaholic. So when my parents got separated, he had, you know, set times to be with us. So in my opinion, it was great because I got to see him a lot more. And I mean, everything really, like, I don't have that story of, you know, I didn't grow up, thank God, with like a ton of abuse or chaos. It was pretty normal. My family was very, very open about their sobriety and, you know, told me from the time I was young the risks of becoming an alcoholic. My brother chose to go one extreme and he was straight edge, never touched a thing. Until much later, and even now still really doesn't do anything. And then I took the other route, which was I'll just try everything and see how that turns out. And I didn't, you know, I do remember my first drink, which I don't know that everybody, you know, people outside these rooms really remember that. I was probably like 8 years old at a family friend's New Year's party, and I had my first sip of alcohol. And I blacked out that night, couldn't walk, couldn't talk, and woke up the next day, and I will never forget that feeling of guilt and shame at that age. Like, I had a blast, but I knew inside that it just wasn't right. And then I really didn't touch anything or have much experience with any drugs and alcohol until about, I guess it was probably like the summer before my freshman year. I started hanging out with a bunch of older kids. I was going to parties. It was something I just did on the weekends. It really didn't seem to affect much else. And then fast forward, maybe I think I was about 14. I had my first panic attack. And, you know, it was really just like a matter of time. I always did have that feeling of not fitting in. I presented as like this extrovert. And I was really good at just like talking to whoever and fitting into whatever circle I needed to, but I was so anxious the entire time and wanted to just crawl out of my skin. And by the time I got to high school, that's, you know, I had a panic attack in school. Definitely just like the social anxiety of it all. I got sent to a therapist and put on my first prescription. And shortly after that, I was in a car accident and was put on medicine for the injuries that I sustained during that. So by 15, I was on several prescriptions. And, you know, I didn't think much of it because the doctor was prescribing it. And I just thought, this is, you know, this is it. Like, I can be normal. I feel like everyone else. That gaping hole that I always felt was filled. I could walk into any situation comfortable, confident, with my head up. And then, you know, slowly what they're giving me isn't working, so I'm just doing my own prescribing. And that went on for several years. I made it through. I was at a pretty intensive college preparatory high school. It was an international boarding school. It was very academic challenging, which I did all right, but I worked my butt off for, like, average grades. And then I decided at that point that I should probably switch to public school for my junior year. And, you know, I told my parents, like, I just want more time to be a kid. I need more time to get back into, like, art and things that I really like. And being at this school I'm at, I just don't have time for that. So they co-signed my shit, and I went to a public school. And I did minimal work and got great grades. And I worked out a co-op program where I only had to go into school for one class and then had the rest of the day free. And that's, like, where I think things turned from, like, pretty much, like, more of a weekend activity to, you know, I got out of school. I had friends in college that had their own houses, and I went there and started my day off drinking at, like, noon. And then would drink until I had to be home at 10 o'clock or whatever. And I didn't have consequences like jail. I didn't get DUIs. You know, that's just not my story. I definitely drove drunk, and how I didn't get caught, I have no idea. The times I was pulled over, you know, I now see that it was probably God watching over me. Nothing came of it. So at this point, you know, I did graduate high school. I had applied to a bunch of colleges all out of state because I was going to leave here. I needed to get out of here. And I got accepted to all of them, at which point I panicked and decided that I wasn't ready, and then had zero plan again, which is pretty much the story of my life. Like, I have all these great ideas, and I jump into them head first, and then I crash every time. So this was no different. So then I decided to go to a local college for a semester. And that clearly didn't work out. You know, I had every reason in the world, and I dropped out of that. And I proceeded then to go into cosmetology school, which is where I met some of my, like, pretty strong partners in crime, and things really took off from there. And I had about, it was a year-long program, and I had about 2 months left. And at this point, you know, I was putting so much in my body, I couldn't really get up to go anywhere. And my attendance wasn't good, and I wasn't going to graduate. And I still now, from the time I was 14, I have continued therapy. You know, I have looked at all my issues. I'm going to Al-Anon because I'm clearly codependent. I am seeing a therapist once a week for my anxiety, which I definitely have. And depression now is an issue. So I go into my therapist, and I'm like, you know, I'm not doing well in school, and they're not going to let me graduate. And she goes, well, you just need a mental leave of absence. I'll sign some paperwork, and they'll let you take a break. So they did. So I just got to get out of that one too. And, you know, it wasn't for several years, like 2 years, till I eventually went back and had to repeat the entire program. And in that time, I, like I always have, was in serious relationships. I always have been, like, a relationship hopper. I couldn't be alone. So I was always from one relationship to the next. And at this point, I had started into a relationship with a guy who drank and used like me for the most part. So it seemed like a pretty good match. And he was in school in Miami, which was really convenient because he was only home sometimes. And it allowed for a lot of freedom for me. And, you know, I did my thing, and I was doing this cosmetology program again. And this is how insane it is. While I was there, I needed my wisdom teeth out. And I decided that the solution for that was every day on lunch, I would walk next door to a bar and get 3 shots of Jameson, because that's what you do for tooth pain, right? Like, why else would you drink whiskey if it wasn't for tooth pain? So, you know, so now I'm drinking during the day, which I really didn't even think about this until probably like the last couple months how insane this was, because it made so much sense to me. You know, it was like the any excuse that I had that I could use to use the way that I needed to, I did. And so I'm still, you know, I'm doing my thing and I'm barely getting to school. I have this boyfriend, you know, he comes home sometimes and, you know, I mean, we get loaded together and fight, and that's like a great relationship. And, you know, we're going to get married and we're going to have kids, and that's going to be great and fix everything. And, you know, at this point, my dad, who had about 20 years sober, I think, I was living in one of his apartments, and he came over, and he lived next door to where I lived, so he knew what kind of hours I was keeping, what kind of people were coming over. He'd been seeing it for a while, and he came over, and he said, you know, listen, like, I see what you're doing, it's not working out, and I just can't support it anymore. He said, so here are your options. Like, you either get rid of the boyfriend, who is, you know, an abusive alcoholic, and you get your shit together, and you can stay in this apartment, and you can keep your car, and you can have your phone, and everything stays the same. You just need to, like, get rid of him and start taking a look at where you're at. And I chose the guy. So I was kicked out with nothing at about, I think I was, like, 18 or 19 at that point. And, you know, I thought it was great because now the boyfriend was home from school and he needed to get a house because I needed somewhere to live. So he goes and he gets a house, and he's got like a couple guys living with him, and it's a great party house, and I move right in. And, you know, slowly I start to get things back in my life a little bit, and now I'm completely isolated from my family because they might know what's going on. I mean, they knew, but I thought they might know. And, so now I'm, like, really getting to do whatever I want. I'm not really talking to anyone. When I talk to them, you know, oh, things are great. You know, all those problems we were having are done now because we live together and it's really good. And fast forward probably about, I wasn't even living there a year. And my boyfriend came home wasted, and he woke me up because I had school and I was asleep, and he woke me up and he was completely incoherent, and he was arguing with me, and I couldn't even understand what he was saying, but like, we had done this so many times, it was like routine. And so I get up and I start packing a bag, and he's just following me around the house yelling at me, you know, and whatever he was saying. I'm like, okay, yeah, like, I'm just gonna go to my mom's for the night, like, you get some sleep, we'll talk in the morning, no big deal. And he's just like screaming and throwing stuff, and I go to leave the house, and I mean, where I live is pretty rural. I mean, I think it's pretty similar to here. So, like, we all shoot guns, a lot of us. We target shoot, we hunt, whatever. So I had a gun in the house. He had actually had it out target shooting that week, so it was on the top of the fridge. And I went to leave the house, and he grabbed the gun. And he pointed at me, and he said, "You're not going anywhere." And the week before this had happened, we had a friend that we went to high school with who was shot and killed by her boyfriend when he was drunk. So, you know, the saving grace in that is that I had known what the outcome looked like, because I knew that she got away during that, went and called for help, and went back in the house, and that's when she got shot. So instead of doing what I normally would do, which was try to fix the situation, I just sort of did everything I could to try to calm him down enough to get out of the house. He, you know, turned the gun on himself and said he was gonna shoot himself. He was so drunk, he fell over. So at that point, I rushed out of the house, and I got in my car. We had dogs. I had the dogs with me, and I just called 911. And they said, you know, what's your emergency? And I said, I don't even really know if it's an emergency. I just didn't know who else to call. And I, like, explained this situation. And this is, like, how chaotic, you know, our lives as alcoholics are, but it's so normal. Like, it really didn't, you know, I really thought, like, I'm not even sure they need to go deal with this, but like, I can't, and I'm leaving, so somebody needs to take care of that. And I left, and ultimately the cops came. He barricaded himself in the house for like hours. I don't really know what came of it. He got arrested for a short period of time. He had just graduated from cop school, and as soon as his name got called in, the whole mood of the thing changed. And all of a sudden it was, well, what were you doing tonight? And what did you say to him? And at that point, because they had had me come back, and at that point when they started questioning me, I said, I'm not doing this. And I got in my car and left. And ultimately, I, you know, got all my stuff out of the house in a matter of hours when I knew that they, you know, he knew how to work the system. So he told them he was suicidal so that he got 302'd instead of going into general pop. And so I knew that he was going to be there for at least a couple hours. So I went over and got all my stuff out. And he called me later that day and he said, I just got back to the house. Where are you? And I said, what do you mean, where am I? I said, I'm like away from you. And he's like, yeah, like I don't really remember what happened last night. And so I tell him what happened. He had zero recollection of any of it. And again, how powerful this disease is. I tried to figure out like what had, you know, gone on that night. I went and like checked his phone. He had wiped it clean. You know, like even in a blackout drunk, we still know to cover our tracks, right? Like nobody's going to figure out what we did. So, you know, so I really had no idea. I tell him what happened. I said, I don't want to talk to you. I moved all my stuff out. Like, that's it. And he really just was totally confused because he didn't remember any of it. So fast forward, he's still trying to, you know, pursue things. I ended up getting a PFA against him just for his protection and mine, you know, because it held me accountable too because I was sick. And, you know, I just wanted that relationship at any cost. And, you know, that was probably like really the first serious consequence of my addiction. That was like my first semi-emotional bottom, I guess. It certainly made me have to take a step back and really look at what I was doing with my life. I had, you know, it was kind of a shock to everyone around me because I had been telling them how great things were. And then all of a sudden they're like, well, what happened? Oh, I have a PFA and I don't live there anymore, you know? And it was really humbling. So I moved back home, and clearly that wasn't enough to look at my using. You know, it was all him. This was a really great excuse as to like, well, I was only screwed up because he was so screwed up. You know, it wasn't actually me, and I was doing what I was doing just to cope with him, and now things are going to be okay, which they weren't. So I'm living at home. You know, my therapist is telling me like, you know, maybe you need to look at your drinking or your using, and maybe, you know, you do have a history of it. And we'd had these conversations before. And so she starts, you know, talking to me about looking at all that. And I said, no, you know what my problem is? It's men. Men are my problem. So I need to go somewhere to deal with that. Like I am very sick and codependent. And I definitely have some, like, you know, love and sex addiction stuff that maybe I should look at. And, like, here, I found this great treatment plan at Karen, and they'll take me for a week, and they'll give me the help I need, and that's all. And, you know, my therapist knew. She was in recovery, too, and she knew that I just wasn't ready. So she just said, yeah, you know what, maybe that's a good idea. Why don't you go to Karen for a week? So I go home and I tell my dad this like great plan that I have because he's still sitting back and watching. He is well aware of where I belong and just like waiting for me to get here. And he said, all right, that's great. He said, why don't you meet me for lunch and we can talk more about it? So I go and I meet him at lunch, and there is a family friend who runs a treatment center up by us called Clearbrook, and he's sitting at the table. And as soon as I walked in, I looked at him and I said, oh, no, I know what this is. No, you don't. Just sit down. Nick just wants to talk to you. It's no big deal. So I sit down and Nick said, listen, your dad told me about your issues and what's going on. And, you know, I know you want to go to Karen, but we've arranged for you to have a bed at Clearbrook. Not for drug and alcohol, though. You can just come for a week. You can leave whenever just to rest because that's what you need, right? You just need some rest. And I told him to F off, and I knew exactly what he was doing. They were not pulling one over on me. And I said, how insane of you to think I'm having trouble with men, and you're going to put me in a place with a ton of men in addiction. That's insane. You know, so I convinced them, and I got to go to Karen. So I went to Karen for a week. which of course did nothing because that wasn't my problem. But it was a good getaway, and it was, you know, I had this really nice cabin and the food was really good. And I did learn a ton about love and relationships that, like, I did absolutely get something out of it. However, I probably would have gotten a lot more had I been sober for the whole thing. But what that did do was kind of get everyone off my back for a little bit. And at this point, you know, everyone had kind of dropped their guard. I got, you know, I had my car, my phone, and, like, all these things back, and I finished cosmetology, and I got this great job at this awesome salon, and it was, like, really well-known. They had several locations. I had a pretty good clientele. I was, like, making good money, and then I hurt my shoulder, and I got a medical leave because I couldn't work. I was seeing a ton of pain management doctors, and it really allowed me this, like, total excuse to just sit home and do whatever I wanted. And nobody could say anything because I actually had an injury this time. And I think I had 3 months off. And I did physical therapy, kind of, and, you know, saw all these doctors. And I go back to work, and now it's been 3 months. Like, women know, you get your hair done, like, once a month. You know, maybe every 6 weeks, maybe eight. But, like, at this point, my clients had gone to other people. And I walk in, I go over to my station, and all my stuff's moved. And there is a new woman working there. And they're like, oh, yeah, we just moved you over there. I'm like, okay. So I, like, go over there, and I'm watching this girl. And she was like, my age. She was actually a year younger. And she has all my clients. They just gave her all my clients. And, you know, selfish, self-centered addict that I am, cannot see my part in this, and I'm furious. Like, I cannot believe that this woman took all my clients. And, you know, and then I remember I just, like, had this vendetta against her. Like, I looked for any reason to be pissed, you know, and found any fault in anybody else so that I didn't have to look at myself. And I was outside on a break, and I was smoking, and she came out, and she had a cigarette, too, and I overheard her talking to somebody about how she was in recovery, and I thought, you know, of course she's in recovery. Like, what could make this any better? Like, I already hate this girl, and now, like, of course she's sober. Like, let's just add that to it. So now I'm really pissed. Like, I just think this is, like, absolutely, like, God is out to get me, you know, just destroying my life. And at this point, I also, because, like, right after I got the PFA, I got into another relationship, like, the same week. I was going to court trying to explain this PFA and, like, going out with this new guy. And so I had been dating him for probably about a year at this point. And we were using together. And it was getting to the point where it didn't matter how much or what combination I put into my body, it didn't work. Nothing worked. And in the past, I would, you know, take a break, but it was really just to make stuff work again, and, like, that usually worked. And I tried that a couple of times, and it didn't. And so the guy that I was seeing at the time, he said, you know, maybe we should get clean. Like, we're just wasting money. It's not working anymore. And, you know, we meaning him, he was buying everything. So, of course, he's thinking, like, yeah, we should get sober. So we have, like, you know, we plan it all out, like good alcoholics. And we have a weekend away. We worked tattoo conventions. And we had one in Atlantic City. So we're like, great, we'll have this, like, blowout weekend. And then Monday we'll get sober. So, which seemed really great, and I was totally on board. And then we have this weekend where, again, nothing's working. So it was an awful weekend. We argued and fought the entire time. We were both sick. And then we get back Monday, and I'm like, all right, so where's the stuff? And he's like, what do you mean? We're getting sober. I was like, oh, no, I thought you were kidding about that. Like, that's not actually the plan, right? And he's like, no, I think it is. Like, I think it's time. And So we started substitution. You know, we just won't do this and we'll do this and we'll wean off of this and try this. And, you know, of course that doesn't work. And we did that for probably about a week. And I was just so sick and tired. I couldn't stand myself. I couldn't stand myself emotionally, mentally, or physically. And I just stopped using everything because there was just no point. Nothing was working. And I detoxed at home because I was too proud to tell my family that they were right. So God forbid I go to a treatment center. So my ego was still like sky high, even as broken down as I was. And I spent weeks literally crawling around the house and sobbing. I couldn't function. I would go to work because I had to keep up appearances because I didn't want anyone to know that I was detoxing. I didn't tell anybody. And I walked in the one day, and by the end of the day, I mean, I was so dead inside. And I saw this girl, the woman that had taken my station at the salon, and she was walking out, and I would say now, in retrospect, it was my first God moment. I hated this girl with every being in me, like just everything. And I saw her and I just like word vomited, "Do you have a minute?" And she's like, "Yeah, I'll meet you outside in a couple minutes." And I go outside and I just started sobbing. And this girl that I hated and I didn't even know, like I'm telling her that I've been detoxing at home and all this stuff I've been doing and like things I didn't tell anybody. And I'm just like a blubbering mess in the parking lot. And I said, "And I know you said that you're sober. Does that mean you go to meetings?" And she's like, "Yes, I go to meetings." And she said, "Well, what are you doing now?" And I said, "Nothing. I have nothing going on." And she said, "Get in my car." And she drove me to a meeting. And although I had been to countless meetings with friends and family my whole life, this was the first one that I went to for me. And I still remember how uncomfortable that meeting was. I couldn't hear a thing. I sat there thinking about myself and how awkward I was and how I hoped nobody was looking at me and, you know, the entire time. And this girl, Sarah, that had taken me, continued to take me to meetings, like as often as she could. And she would introduce me to people. And I was kind of like still not really fully buying it, but I knew that hour at that meeting was more relief than I was getting at any other point during my day. You know, because it was several months before I even slept, you know, with like the restless leg and just like everything. I mean, I just couldn't function. And for that 1 hour, even though I heard nothing, I was at more peace than I was at any other point. So I kept going. And after about, I think it was like 2 months, the meeting stopped working and I wasn't feeling okay. And the boyfriend at this point, I think he was just drinking. And I'm going to meetings and coming home and he's like wasted with friends over. Which also then became not fun for him. So then he really tried getting sober too. So at about 2 months, and I'm saying like, these meetings just aren't really doing it. And Sarah's like, "Well, you know, it's probably time to get a sponsor. Like, you should probably go through the steps." And but I haven't met anyone, I said. "I'm not connected with anyone. I am not going to ask anyone to do that." And she said, "Well, you know, why don't you let me temporarily sponsor you?" She said, "You know, no commitment," because of course I'm like terrified of commitment. "No commitment. We'll just start going through the steps until you meet somebody that you want to sponsor you." So she took me through the steps and things started to get better. Not immediately, but things started to get better. And that woman actually remained my sponsor up until last year. She became my best friend. And we got engaged together and we got pregnant together. And then she got diagnosed with cancer at 26. And within less than a year, they had to do an emergency C-section and she passed away. So I was blessed enough and lucky enough to have like one sponsor, you know, through this whole sobriety. Like, she was everything and she left me with such an amazing message to then carry on to the women that I sponsor. And that's like her legacy. And it was just, I'm just so grateful that she was in my life. And after that had happened, it did take me a while to get another sponsor, but I did. So back to, I guess, her taking me through the steps. At 3 months, when I got my 90-day chip, I called my dad and his wife, and they're both in recovery. And I said, I really need to talk to you guys. And I had been trying to get together with them for like a week. Because at night, when I got my 90-day chip, I decided that this wasn't something that I was going to like screw up like I did everything else. And I didn't want to let them down. So I thought 90 days seems secure enough that like I'll tell them that I'm sober now. And I'm trying to get together with them for like over a week. And then finally, I get there, and I'm like getting ready. We did dinner and stuff, and I'm getting ready to leave. And I was like, I really need to talk to you guys. And my dad had this like the gun room. It was this vault in his house that was just filled with guns. And he brings me in there and sits me down with his wife. And he's like, yeah. So what did you want to talk to us about? And I'm like, well, and I like take my chip out and I like slide it across the table. And I'm like, I'm 90 days sober. And they both look at each other and start hysterically laughing. They go, oh, we thought you were going to tell us you were pregnant. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm sober. And they're like, well, thank God, that's a relief. So that was about it, you know? I mean, there wasn't a whole, and there was no I told you so, because that's for sure what I thought I was going to get, was a whole lot of, like, we told you you'd end up here, why didn't you listen? I didn't get any of that. You know, everybody that had known me growing up in the rooms with my family just, like, open arms whenever I walked into a meeting. So then, let me think. At this point, my boyfriend now, he was sober too, without a program, and was miserable. Because we all know that being sober without a program is worse than anything else. So I'm coming home and I'm like excited and happy about life because I'm going through like the steps and I'm going to meetings, and he wants to kill himself, literally. He is like suicidal, miserable all the time. And he came home one day and he told me that he was on the interstate on 81 coming home from work, and he said that he swerved into oncoming traffic. And he's like, I just can't do this anymore. So I called one of our friends that he had actually introduced me to that was sober, and he came down and started working the steps with him, like, that day. And things got a lot better. You know, we both were, like, working this program. I had fast forward, like, about a year, and he did relapse for a brief period, but then got sober again. And we, it's just amazing what this program does. Like, we went from like living on people's couches, detoxing in random houses, to eventually buying our own house and getting engaged and having a child. Like, that's my life now. You know, I own my home. Like, we have cars, you know, that we own. Like, that's like a miracle, you know? We have, you know, a beautiful son. It's just, I have, like, I always loved animals, and I always, like, volunteered at rescues and stuff, even in my addiction. And, you know, we have, like, all these rescue dogs and rescue chickens and rescue rats and, like, anything else you could think of. You know, but it's just like, it's just amazing, because if you asked me before I got sober what was my wildest dream, it would have been fancy cars, a huge house, lots of money, probably no kid, maybe a husband, maybe not. And like, now I can honestly say that my life is beyond my wildest dreams. Like, it is so fulfilling. And I recently had this crazy month, this last month, which is just, it started, I had a friend that I used to use with, that I had to cut ties with because I got sober, and that friendship just couldn't sustain without drugs. So she'd been out there for a while. She had a child that got taken away from her and her husband, and I had heard a few months ago that they were both had gone to treatment and were living together. and were getting their son back, and I ran into her, and it was like this awesome thing to just see her, because the last time I saw her, she was just like a carcass. There was nothing there. There was no light, and she was just like working the steps, and they were about to get their son back, and I got a call that she hung herself. And, you know, she only had like 3 months sober. And I'll never know. I'm not going to try to figure it out. But, like, I would imagine that something just didn't click for her, you know, that she wasn't in these rooms for enough time. And shortly after that, I had to make a decision to put down one of my dogs that I'd had for 11 years, which was incredibly hard. And so I had this, like, crazy, like, 2 weeks. And then I'm like, all right, like, things should start slowing down. And then I'm out with one of my good friends from my home group and my support group. And she has a 16-year-old daughter who had been in and out of the rooms, in and out of treatment. They didn't know what to do with her. She had overdosed several times in the last few months. 15 years old. Like, she just had turned 16 in October, the beginning of October. And, you know, I'm out at this, like, trick-or-treat thing with my son and my friend Desiree, and she gets a call that her daughter, Grace, is missing. And Grace, like, would go missing, so it wasn't a huge panic. Well, they found her in a hotel room in Upper Darby, dead, 16 years old. And she had been sober for, like, a month and a half at that point. So what happened, though, is that in this horrible tragedy, my home group, like, we're all so close that this entire group of support just showed up. Like, no, like, barely any calls even had to be made. Like, we all, Desiree was there. She got her, you know, her two sons and her husband. And 15, 20 people showed up with coffee, food, you know, anything that you could think of. Tissues. Like, they just, cigarettes. Like, everything. And just showed up at someone's house. And we just spent days there. You know, and all of us were there and sober and able to, like, make the funeral arrangements for them. Like, literally make all the arrangements because this family was in need. And to be a part of, like, a support group like that, I never found that outside these rooms. You know, my friends dipped when things got hard. Like, they were not around to help out. So it was just, like, this beautiful thing. And with Grace, though, there was a criminal investigation, so it was like a 2-week drawn-out process before, you know, we were able to get her back and do the arrangements and everything. And, you know, I didn't spend a day away from Desiree or her family, and we buried Grace on Tuesday, and then Friday, Desiree overdosed and died. And, you know, and it's just as difficult as this time has been, and that this month has just been, like, there's no words, you know, to have a family. There's two boys, a 17 and 18-year-old, that just lost their mom and their sister. And there's no words, and there's nothing that's going to bring them back or fix that. But the love and support that has shown up because of these rooms is just amazing, you know, and really puts things in perspective. You know, when I lost people when I was out using, you know, they were gone, and I was alone. But losing people in sobriety, like, I have this support group and these people around me that, like, I'm never alone. I can call people and they actually show up. They actually answer my calls. Like, it's just such a blessing. And none of that is possible without a higher power, because if I didn't have this, like, bigger being that controlled things, I would be micromanaging everything. And I would be trying to figure it out, and it would be all about me and what I lost and how sad I am. But that's not it. You know, through this whole thing, like, God filled me up enough to be able to literally spend 2 weeks with a family making two separate funeral arrangements. Like, I do hair. I did the hair and makeup for both their bodies. I've never done that in my life. And, like, if you asked me if I ever would have considered that a year ago, hell no. But, you know, when it came to Grace, a 16-year-old girl, her makeup's pretty important to her. And her mom wants to make sure that she looks the way she wants her to, you know, and because of, like, this connection with a higher power and knowing that, like, my job is just to be a vessel and serve him, I can do these super uncomfortable things that I never would have done in my addiction. And, you know, and even just doing things like coming and speaking when I'm asked to. I hate speaking. 5 years sober and I still hate speaking. It does not, you know, it's just not something I like doing. When I was in my addiction, I loved being the center of attention. Now I prefer to be in the background a little more. But I show up because that's what AA taught me. And that's what the steps taught me. And that's what my sponsor taught me. And if I didn't follow direction, God knows where I'd be today. You know, somebody could be planning my funeral because enough people have died around me that I know what would have happened if I didn't end up here. But I also know that it's a continuation. You know, I'm never done. Like, I thought when I first got in here, you get through the steps and you're good. And that's just, like, not at all the case. And I have had plenty of bouts of doing that. I get complacent. About every, like, a year and a half it hits where I'm like, oh, I'm good. I don't need meetings. It still happens. I, like, expect it every year. So about, you know, a year and a half goes by and I'm like, yeah, I'm just not going to go to that meeting. And then I'm just not going to go to that next one. And then I'm not showing up and people aren't seeing me. And I'm not doing anything for my sobriety. And you know what? Although, like, the obsession has been removed, I don't necessarily think, like, I'm going to use today. I'm miserable. Nobody wants to be around me. I'm confrontational. I'm an anxious, like, ball of nerves all the time. And then the pain gets great enough. I don't pick up, thank God. And I go to a meeting. And I reconnect. But also, at this point, my sobriety, which, like, it's only the last year that I've really found this, like, my support group checks up on me, which is huge. You know, if I'm not at a meeting, they text me or call me and ask if I'm all right. And that's good because, like, this program depends. It's an us program for a reason. Like, we have to hold each other accountable. Because clearly if I was enough to hold myself accountable, I wouldn't need these rooms and I wouldn't need these steps and I could get sober on my own. But that is not at all what my experience has shown me. And I just hope that I can continue, you know, to do the things I need to do and not, you know, maybe it'll be every 3 years that I think I don't need meetings. That would be improvement, you know, maybe. But it's just like, it's just this continuum and I just have to constantly do what is asked of me and serve God and not myself. And that's really all I can ask for. And thanks for listening.
Okay. We're just going to have a thank you, Chelsea. Thank you for speaking. We're just going to have Tom come up and share a couple words here with us quick. Thank you.
I'm an alcoholic called Tom.
Hey, Tom.
Thank you for your message. That was awesome. About 10 minutes here. My heart is pounding. I've been sitting in this meeting for I don't even know how long. Not that long, but long enough to enjoy every moment of it. You know, I was listening to your message, and I was thinking about, you know, brutal honesty. And when it comes to speakers, you know, this is a speaker meeting, and I go to a lot of meetings, and I often think about, you know, when I'm sitting there in the back and I'm listening to, you know, what Thomas wants to hear. What Thomas wants, what's the light bulb, you know, what's the reconnection to God he wants? What does he want to get out from the meeting? And it's that kind of that selfish tendency. But when I unpiece everything and unravel it, kind of what you talked about is, you know, all I could ever ask for from a speaker or from anybody that comes up here or that comes up into my life or anything is honesty. Brutal honesty. That's what you shared with us tonight. And you know, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I like to reference the book, and I like to try to always stick to the book because I don't know what I'm doing. And I wake up every morning and I tell God that I don't know what I'm doing. And therefore, like, I need a set of guidelines. I need a set of principles. I need a set of every single thing in my life to be structured and centered around a loving and powerful God and all of his children. And recently, I've noticed that that a lot of aspects of my life that I have been getting dishonest, that I haven't been 100% truthful. that I haven't been completely dependent upon a loving God that has kind of been flowing through me for quite some time now. You know, that's at the very gist, that's what it is. I'm not going to get specific, because it, you know, that principle in itself is a principle that should not be compromised at any point of any program or non-program of life. I think it's a principle that's been instilled upon me since I was young. You know, I was reading the other night about agnostics and the fundamental flow or power of God in us at birth, or, you know, however you want to call it. And anyway, speaking, things have been, I've noticed that, and I've noticed it because, you know, immediately today, it's not hard to feel off kilter, you know, when I'm apart from God, when I'm doing things that I should be doing or not be doing. It's pretty immediate, and it's just a matter of crawling back and asking for that reconnection and asking to serve Him again and asking to do the same things that put me in a viable place to stand here right now. And I was starting to get in my head a little bit, and things were starting to crash in on me. The last week, a lot of things have been happening, and I've went through relationship struggles. I've went through family struggles of things going on internally, and the hardest blow is I had a really close friend of mine just relapse. I had a really close friend of mine just relapse. Somebody I put a lot of my love, I shouldn't even say a lot of it, all of my love. I put all of my love into this person that I grabbed from a rehab, you know, months, you know, almost a year ago. I didn't know this person from a can of paint. I didn't want anything from him. I didn't have any profit motive, like as the book says. In some way, you know, I formed a codependency instead of a God dependency on that. And I tried to do the next right thing. I tried to, you know, perform His will and use His guidance and all these things, and waking up and praying and meditating and doing this for weeks and weeks and months and now years. And, I purchased a home, you know, as a result of this. And I as you talked about, I kept on trying to do the next right thing and trying to help God's children and just keep pushing ahead and trying to conquer everything that Thomas wants to do, and not what God wants to do sometimes. And as a result of that too, all these things came crashing in. And, you know, like I said, this week has been extremely humbling and extremely full of enlightenment and just a lot of emotions that I've been neglecting for a long time, because, you know, my sponsor always tells me that, you know, feelings and emotions aren't necessarily true. And once again, back into being honest and truthful, that, you know, that's only part of it. But, you know, to differentiate between what's flowing through me from God and what's Thomas flowing through himself is two totally different things. And I think that's one of the hardest things we come through with time in this program, or no time: what's being driven from self or what's being driven from God. And trying to segment that, and trying to really truly understand what God's will is. And you know, I've been in turmoil, and like you said, I have a support. I have the love of this home group. I have the love of so many people in AA, and so much, and it's just been pouring out love. I have a solution much more broad than just the 12 steps. The 12 steps is obviously the core of a solution that I live today. But ultimately, the 12 steps brought me through a spiritual experience, and the spiritual experience brought me through a personal relationship with the God of my understanding today. And that was the ultimate gift, and that was the commitment that you made, that you kept on talking about, you kept on showing up, that this never stops. And, you know, despite all that, and having to be in the house with somebody and having to throw out, you know, alcohol and drugs in my hand and have certain things in my hand, I was never so far away from a drink or a drug in my life this past week. I was never so far, and I was never so close to God in my life with both those things in my hand. So with that being said, you know, if you're hurting in anything, if you're hurting in anything right now, you know, drugs, alcohol, a lack of a relationship or flowing with God, you know, anything going on with family or friends, please talk to somebody. please talk to somebody, and please get with somebody that that you can try to be open and honest with and truthful about. Because, you know, the truth sets us free. It certainly has been setting me free lately. And that's all I have. Thanks for having me, Michelle.